Okay. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Tate Britain. Thank you all for coming tonight for tonight's debate on multiculturalism in the arts. My name is Paul Goodwin. I'm cross-cultural curator here at Tate. And tonight's debate is directly inspired by Yinka Shonibar's new work, Nelson's Ship in a Bottle, that was yesterday unveiled in Trafalgar Square on the fourth plinth. Yinka says that this wonderful work is, to quote, a celebration of London's immense ethnic wealth, giving expression to and honouring the many cultures and ethnicities that are still breathing precious wind into the sails of the United Kingdom. This is, I believe, an artwork that speaks directly to the time we live in today. It's a work that responds to and reflects in many ways the complex and painful histories of empire and conquest of this country. But at the same time, it also reflects the unique melting pot of cultures and nationalities that make London one of the most dynamic and multicultural cities on the planet. This ambiguity, I think, is precisely at the heart of what our distinguished panel will get to grips with tonight by focusing in particular on how these issues around multiculturalism play out in the arena of the arts in this country. I would also add, of course, that this is a particularly important time to be discussing this issue as we enter a so-called new age of austerity in the wake of the financial crisis and the LibCon coalition. Just some quick housekeeping. Can I ask you to switch off your mobile phones, if you have them, or put them on silent? And also to say that after the discussion, which will be led by Kwame Kwe Amar, there will be time for questions for the audience. So can I ask you then to raise your hand if you want to ask a question and wait until the mic comes to you, because we are recording tonight. Before I introduce the panel, can I give my heartfelt thanks to all the sponsors and partners who have made this event happen and who have been so supportive of this project. That is the Trust Bank of Lagos, Nigeria, the Stephen Friedman Gallery in London, the Fourth Plinth Commissioning Group, the Mayor of London, and the Greater London Authority. So thank you to all of the partners for that. So to our panel. Tonight, our chair will be Kwame Kwe Amar. Kwame is a playwright, broadcaster, and actor. He's currently writer-in-residence for BBC Radio Drama, an associate artist at the National Theatre of Great Britain, at the Centre Stage in Baltimore, and the Congo Square Theatre Company in Chicago in the States. Between 2003 and 2007, Kwame wrote three key plays set in the habitats of the African Caribbean community in Britain: Elmina's Kitchen, Fix Up, and Statement of Regret. I'm sure many of you have seen these plays, all of which have premiered at the National Theatre, with Elmina's Kitchen transferring to London's West End. And in fact, Kwame was the first African Caribbean playwright to have had that honour. Amongst other awards, he's won the Evening Standard Charles Winter Award for Most Promising Playwright, the Screen Nation Award for Favourite TV Actor, and the 100 Black Men of Britain Public Figure Award. Kwame's latest play in 2009, he wrote and directed Seize the Day as part of the Not Black and White season, very successful, I should add, at the Tricycle Theatre in London. As well as being a presenter on Newsnight Review and Culture Show, he's written for many national newspapers. As an actor, Kwame has played Finlay Newton, the BBC's Casualty, and is soon to appear in the TV series Skins. Yinka Shonibar, MBE, was born in London and raised in Nigeria, where Yinka has gained an international reputation by exploring issues of race and class through a range of media that includes sculpture, painting, photography, and installation art. Adopting a richly complex, unconventional approach, Yinka lampoons often the concept of achieving status of what might be called cultural authenticity. His works, simultaneously innocent and subversive, addresses a range of cultural and historical issues, and in the process, blurs the boundaries of design, ethnography, and contemporary art. Yinka is shown at galleries around the world, and his work is in many national and international collections, including, of course, the Tate. He is a Turner Prize winner and a member of the Order of the British Empire. Sorry? A nominee, excuse me. Mistake number one before the... Nominee. I stand corrected, Yinka. Perhaps we can debate that. And of course, his latest work is the celebrated Fourth Commission that we are talking about this evening. Miniru Mertzer is the mayor's advisor on arts and culture. Miniru has a background in policy research and has written and lectured on issues related to cultural policy, race and identity. She's worked for a range of cultural and charitable organisations, including the Royal Society of Arts, the independent think tank Policy Exchange, and, of course, she spent some time here at Tate. She did a PhD in sociology, which she completed in 2009, which looked at cultural policy and multiculturalism in the UK. She's presented a number of programmes at BBC, including The Business of Race and Fighting Chance. And she's edited a book, Culture Vultures, is the UK Arts Policy Damaging the Arts, and was also the co-author of the report Living Apart Together, British Muslims and the Paradox of Multiculturalism. Matthew Taylor became Chief Executive of the Royal Society of Arts in November 2006. Prior to this appointment, he was the Chief Advisor on Political Strategy to the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, at the time. Matthew was appointed to the Labour Party. I did get that right, Matthew. That is the right Prime Minister. Just to... Okay. Just to... Okay. Matthew was appointed to the Labour Party in 1994 to establish Labour's rebuttal operation. His activities before the Labour Party included being a county councillor, a parliamentary candidate, and a university research fellow. Until 1998, Matthew held several important positions within the Labour Party, including Assistant General Secretary and Director of Policy during the 1997 general election. He was Director of the Institute of Public Policy Research, Britain's leading left-of-centre think tank, between 1999 and 2003. And he's also a frequent media commentator and writer for several national publications. And last but not least, Yasmin Alibi Brown is a columnist, writer and cultural commentator. Yasmin came to the UK in 1972 from Uganda after completing undergraduate degree at Makerere University, later going on to do a postgraduate at Oxford. She's a journalist who has written for The Guardian, Observer, The New York Times, and other national and international magazines and newspapers, and is now a regular columnist on The Independent and London Evening Standard. She's also a radio and television broadcaster and is the author of several books, including No Place Like Home, Mixed Feelings, Who Do We Think We Are, and After Multiculturalism, all essential reading in terms of understanding this issue. In 2001, she was appointed an MBE for services to journalism. Her new book, The Settlers... Sorry, which she returned. Mistake number two. her new book, The Settlers' Cookbook, a fond memoir on East Asian Africans, was published in the spring of 2009 and was a book of the week on BBC Radio 4. So without further ado, I'll shut up and hand over now to Kwame Kwayama to start our discussion this evening. Thank you, Kwame.
Thank you very much, Paul. So now you know all of our life stories. there won't be any questions about us. So first of all, thank you all for coming. Just a little bit of housekeeping. We've got roughly about an hour and 15 minutes to kind of have this discussion. I'm going to kick off a little bit on the stage by asking people their opinions to some of the questions I'm going to ask, and then I'm going to throw it out to us. In typical African style, this is a kind of call and response thing. So once I open out to you, let's please have some weird and wonderful questions. So if I kind of go, good evening.
Good evening.
Okay, there's nobody in this house and no one has ever been to Africa. I'm going to say, good evening.
Hey, good evening.
Thank you very much. Brilliant. So here we are. Debating message in a bottle, multiculturalism. I'm going to jump straight to Yinka, actually, and say, Yinka, and ask, actually, Yinka, what is the message? And if the message is about multiculturalism, are they contradictions in terms, multiculturalism and art?
You know, first of all, you know, when you talk about multiculturalism, or when you talk about the relationship of immigrants, who are in this country in Britain. There's always this kind of power relationship. There's a kind of us and them. What I set out to do in my work is to rather confuse the issue. So I'm very interested in the idea of the Trojan horse. The idea that actually you make things rather difficult by making it impossible for people to know which side you're on. So that there is no us and them. Actually, I might be quote-unquote the other. I would actually like some of the trappings of the establishment too, thank you very much.
You've got one, right, with the MBE?
Well, my decision to use the MBE is, as you know, it's ambivalent and it's political. And there's a reason for that. I think that by making yourself the opposition, you make actually things easy. I think it's rather more difficult when you confuse the issue. But I don't know, if you want me to speak specifically about, I think perhaps I should, I'll just speak specifically about this artwork. As you know, that's, you know, it's Trafalgar Square, there's the fourth plinth. You know, it seemed quite obvious to me just because of the history of the place. Nelson's column is at Trafalgar Square. He won the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805, a battle against Napoleon. And the victory at Trafalgar gave Britain freedom of the seas. Therefore, empire was able to prosper for the next 100 years and expand. Me speaking English to you now, with some kind of discomfort, actually, because I'd rather be speaking Yoruba to you. You know, but I have to speak this damned language. You know, pardon the expression. But, so, even my own identity is being formed by that encounter. So basically, I mean, for me, it just seemed the act of actually changing the sails of the victory to African textiles. I mean, in a way, that's where my intervention is. Now, I will end so that you can just continue. I'll end with a question, really. And the question is, is this actually pro-colonialism or is it against? That's the question I'm going to end with. Am I actually celebrating? Is there something, you know, am I celebrating Nelson's victory or is this a critique of Nelson's impact? But I will just stop there for now.
Minera, I'm going to throw that question to you.
I wish you hadn't come to me on that particular question. I don't know what the answer was when Yinka created the work, but I think it's far too simple to say that Nelson's victory was an unalloyed good or bad. There's obviously a very complex history that follows, that comes out of empire, and I think we have to accept that some of the benefits of living in a diversity have come from that history, without accepting all the negativity and the pain that came from it as well. But the thing that really struck me about the work, and which I love, is the very subtle twist of the use of the fabric, because whilst there is one surface twist, there's an appearance of a twist in terms of reproducing Nelson's ship with this batik material. The material itself, which we associate with Africa, was imported from Holland. And I think that the piece says a lot about the fact that cultures are extremely fluid, and historically things have come to places and have evolved and become associated with those places, but they may have come from somewhere else. So there's a sort of celebration of change and the fluidity and the inherent difference within culture, which I think is a very positive thing, and obviously London is a great beneficiary of that. And I suppose just to try and kick off the debate, my critique of multiculturalism as a policy, as a set of initiatives and programs that are led by the state and authorities, is that it actually strangles the life out of that fluidity by setting cultures in quite rigid categories. So Yinka, for example, would be defined as a black artist, which is obviously true on one level, but it says a very limited amount about his art and what he does as well, I would say, but obviously he might well disagree, he sat next to me. And I think that there is a problem with the way in which the state co-opts categories and racial and ethnic labels and identifies people in that way, because I think it actually stops them from experiencing the change and the fluidity that cities like London can afford us.
So are you saying that there's a kind of Adam Smithian free go for all when it comes to identity and art?
Well, I don't know if it's Adam Smithian. I mean, I think it's...
Because you kept talking about state.
Yeah, I come from... Yeah, I suppose I have a natural aversion to, you know, the state getting too involved in culture, and I say that as someone who works for a, you know, regional authority.
Indeed.
But, you know, I think, you know, the state should create the conditions in which culture would flourish, which I think is right through funding and so on. But I don't think it should start to define people too narrowly. I think it should allow people to choose for themselves how they define themselves. And, I mean, my critique of lots of arts policy is that by, putting targets on the number of black artists or black organisations that should get funding or that should do particular kinds of work, that it actually boxes in those artists, it ghettoises them, and runs counter to any kind of, you know, a genuinely multicultural, diverse approach, which is to allow people to choose and to adopt influences and to define those categories.
Thank you. Yasmin, I mean, on my way here, I went to see it yesterday, but I thought I'd pop in and see it again. And just for getting here, and there were like loads, I mean, like literally 30, 40 tourists all snapping it, really excited about it. And do you think that they see a message in this piece of art? And does art have to have a message?
Well, it's in a bottle. So it's got a message. It's a message in a bottle. I want to go back to a couple of things that were said, because I find myself both agreeing and disagreeing as I heard the words from both sides. If we did live in a fair world, if we did live in a world where whoever you were, you got selected for a safe seat and you got into Parliament, and we lived in that kind of meritocratic world. We've just seen an election which has totally shocked me, that in the 21st century, we ended up in this country. In America, they got Barack Obama. In this country, we managed to get an election of all white males. Not only that, but everybody who was telling the story about that election was also all white male. Until we change that, until that changes, God knows how long that will take. I do think that we have to constantly remind ourselves who isn't in this field of attention, who is so talented but isn't being seen, who is invisible. And because I do agree with Munira that, you know, everybody gets boxed in. I mean, I always say, you know, the only time I've ever been invited to the BBC for arts programmes is when they are about to do a controversial, has to be controversial, Muslim thing. Otherwise, I'm not there. I did English for 8 years. I studied Victorian literature, but I'm not there. And therefore, because the gatekeepers are so, still so, consciously or unconsciously, self-reproducing, we do constantly have to talk about it and make sure that public money, if nothing else, serves the kind of city that is being celebrated in this message in the bottle. Art doesn't have to have a message, and when it sets out to give you a message, it probably fails. What's very interesting, I was very struck by what the non-message really in this work of art, that it's subversive, there are questions, there are no real answers. Is it a celebration? Is it a subversion? I think that's right. But the minute you say this work of art or this play or, you know, this book is celebrating this community, you may as well inject it and put it down, really. Having said that, I mean, I just want two very quick points. I'm extremely alarmed at the assumption now that we are okay. We've done black people. Everybody's got a fair chance. Why on earth are you bothering us? We've done the business. And actually, you know, some amazing things are happening. Lovely to see Mira Sahil in Doctor Who. I mean, that is fantastic progress. That's exactly what Mira was talking about. But at the same time, I still look at television and I see white chaps traveling around the world on trains telling us about Africa, telling us about Indonesia, telling us about... and nobody else. So I do think we have to keep an eye on that.
Good. Matthew, I mean, I remember in 97 when Tony Blair came in, the Labour administration came in, right at the heart of its arts policy was inclusion. And many of us, particularly playwrights, found ourselves searched out. The theatres went out and they seeked to find us to make sure that theatre began to at least represent the voice of modern Britain. Here we are 13 years on. Should we still be talking about art and multiculturalism?
Well, if I can start by just saying something about the work, which I love, and I hope it isn't a kind of completely philistine, unsophisticated thing to say, but it is fantastic to have something which is clever and witty and creative and challenging, but also beautiful, actually. You know, I'm sorry if that's an old-fashioned thing to say. Maybe it shows my age, and I don't really understand art. But, you know, it's a beautiful thing. As you approach it, you want to get closer to it. And as I watch people walk around it because they wanted to see it from different angles. You know, they wanted to see what happened when you had the sun behind you and the sun. It was fantastic. And the great thing, of course, about art is you can put any interpretation you want on it. And the thing that I haven't read about in the various reviews, which all have been really positive, so that is, you know, yet another kind of step forward for contemporary art. We've moved a long way from the bricks in the Tate all those years ago and the kind of horror and outrage. But the thing I haven't seen mentioned that I thought about this was the cork was what hit me, because I kind of, there's something about looking at it which makes me feel as though any minute the cork is going to shoot out. You know, it doesn't, you know, when you normally buy a ship in a bottle and you put it on the mantelpiece,
My mum had loads, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And you always say, why have you got all this crap? And then she says, what did you buy me for my birthday?
And you said, a ship in a bottle.
Exactly. Yes. So, they don't have that feel, but this had this feel to me, and I wonder whether this was, I thought that kind of was part of it as well, which is that whatever is going on, however it is we try to reach some kind of settlement to kind of celebrate diversity or to come to terms with colonial pasts, you know, there will always be a possibility that the cork will leap out and that this will break into a different kind of discourse.
Just a little thing, really. Did you notice what it says on the seal? The red seal there?
Yeah.
No, I haven't seen what it says.
It says YSMBE.
Yeah.
Yinka Schoenberg MBE.
All right. Yeah.
And that's another thing that's important to think about. Why? But I'll just let you continue. You know, but I just thought that
thank you for that esoteric intervention.
Have I said something really stupid? I'm sorry.
No. On the contrary, you're doing very well.
Thank you. Thank you. That is reassuring. You know, on the point about inclusion, I mean, first of all, I'm going to say one sentence because I'm kind of sulking because Labour's out of power and will be out of power for a very long time.
It's okay, Matthew. Do you good.
This has been a kind of a fantastic period for art and culture. There's no question about that in all sorts of ways. And maybe we will miss it more when it's not so easy. And that's not a critique of the incoming government. It was never going to be so easy because of the state of public finances. What was interesting, I think, is in the more recent years, what's happened to arts funding is it's moved away from being about kind of big projects and been more about art in the community and art which seeks to engage with the community. And I think that opens up interesting questions about the relationship between, you know, high culture and community-based culture. And this kind of question of the role that art plays, its kind of social function, you know, that takes us to all these debates that have been going on for ages, and I'm just writing something about this at the moment, about, you know, this terrible debate between art, intrinsic value of art and the instrumental value of art, and whether we should, how we do feel about art which has a specific social purpose as against art which is, you know, beyond that, that kind of rather crude idea. So I think when we talk about art and multiculturalism, we're going to be forced to look at those kinds of issues, because of course there is some funding of art which is very explicitly there to try to bring communities together. With the kind of social engineering project which Manira feels has been so misconceived. I think in your work it's a much more kind of complex process that's going on, not as instrumental at all.
I ask that question because, and any of you can jump in to answer that, including you, Yinka. Because I'm worrying, or at least I think I'm hearing, that the very concept, I mean, we've only started to use the word multiculturalism again in the last few months. I mean, it almost died after 7/7. Is it a spent force as a concept, even before we get to art and its interrelation with that?
Well, I mean, what I want to know, I think the first thing you have to clarify is the definition of multiculturalism, because actually that definition, it does mean different things to different people.
What does it mean to you, Yinka?
What does it mean to me? Because I'm an artist and I'm not a bureaucrat, I don't have the political aspect that bureaucrats have with the term. Because I see, you know, for me, if multiculturalism has actually become a particular stereotype within government speak or bureaucrat speak, that's quite separate from saying that there is a culture in which there are many peoples from different parts of the world. That will not change. And those many peoples from different parts of the world will have cultural expressions that cannot be stopped, whether you say multiculturalism is dead or not. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Totally.
So the bureaucratic fixing of the term is quite separate from the lived reality of feeling the need to express one's own culture.
Did you, when you started to think about this project, did you find yourself inspired or hemmed in by the concept of multiculturalism, by the concept of even being seen as an artist of colour going onto the fourth plinth?
You know, when I was young, one of my favourite songs was Say It Loud, I'm Black and Proud by James Brown. And for me, difference has been an extremely positive force. You know, I'm not, it's not negative. If there's a funding pocket for black people, if you like, I'll be the first in the queue to apply for it. It's money. You know, I don't care, call it what you want, put a label on it, just give me the money. You know, so I think really it's what you do with it that's important. I think having the opportunity to express yourself, when you're in the minority, perhaps some people call it is it positive discrimination. The civil rights movement, you know, we can talk about that. It moved things forward. But there was an aspect of positive discrimination that was necessary in the whole kind of civil rights movement in the United States. Obama, without positive discrimination, Obama wouldn't be there, period. So sometimes you do have to take, you know, political parties are talking about women candidates. Sometimes you do have to take certain steps to readdress history. So, and in a way, the whole multiculturalism debate, perhaps, you know, maybe it sort of went too far, maybe, but I certainly politically think that, you know, it's a necessary step to have some of this, because it will not happen if you think it will happen naturally. It won't, because of the power relationships.
Very good. Munira, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I think I want to say I disagree, and I disagree with Yasmin to some extent. Because I completely understand that black artists would not refuse funding that is for exclusively for them. But I think, on the whole, we should interrogate some of the effects that come from that kind of positive discrimination. And I do think that the world has changed in the last 20 years. I think there is less racism than there was. And I know that's a really controversial thing to say, but
some people might just think it's wrong, not controversial.
Or both. I do, and I think that that as a society we find it very difficult to admit that and to say that. I think that there are real barriers to lots of groups being able to succeed in the arts world, including for white working class people. But they're not the same as the kind of prejudice and discrimination that would have existed 20 years ago. And in a way, the problem with a lot of the positive discrimination schemes that you see and the special funding schemes and the special university courses that are only for black and minority people is that they actually reinforce an idea amongst a lot of black and minority people that there is a real... there is a racist barrier against them, and it actually discourages them from applying for other schemes. And there is a, I think there is a problem, which is that there is a kind of system of ghettoising black and minority artists and curators and people who work in the arts world, where they only end up applying for the positive action schemes and the diversity schemes. And what I'm arguing is that actually, in the interests of equality, we should address the underlying reasons why lots of people don't go to art school or don't become curators. You know, what are the barriers in terms of having to work for free doing internships or not having access to those kinds of educational opportunities? And that those are very difficult factors to address. They're not easy. You can't deal with them through schemes which, you know, that meet a target for particular kinds of groups to get jobs, and that in some ways trying to do it that way is short-circuiting a really important process, which is to address, you know, real structural problems in the arts world.
Can I was too
just so yeah. I don't think, see where your evidence is, Munira, that racism has more or less gone down. I think racism mutates. Of course, it's not as bad as 1972 when I came. We've just been through an election where the using anti-immigration rhetoric, I heard and saw the kind of racism I honestly thought we had excised from this country. I can send you evidence of pure racism experienced by black men, by Muslim men. I think it's a very dangerous position to take to announce the end of something.
Well, I never said it was the end.
What did you say?
I said there is far less than there was.
No, you didn't say that, actually. Because if you'd said that, I wouldn't...
I didn't say the end of racism. Of course, that would be silly.
With respect, I think you actually said there was a lot less racism than it was, which gives the illusion that it is, in fact, because the rest of the qualification was that it is approaching its deathbed and we shouldn't need to put a lot of focus on it. I know what she said, madam. I'm simply saying that the focus of the point was that therefore we no longer need to focus on it in the way that we did before.
And I think that the best scenario would be that everybody did get a fair and equal chance and were seen as artists or writers or, you know, in the way Yinka's now seen. The truth of the matter is that access, and it isn't because young people or ambitious people don't know how to play the game. There are still presumptions and assumptions made about people on the basis of their background. Now, the Royal Court, doing its special young playwrights program for young Muslims, was exactly the sort of thing I suspect you wouldn't be against. Out of that, you've now got a young woman, Alia Banu, who won the Evening Standard Young Playwright of the Year Award. She would not have been seen had she not had this entry provided for her through, I agree, sometimes, you know, a ghetto scheme. But it helped her make it. So I would be really worried if we suddenly decided that the world is so changed, okay, I shall use your word, is so changed, we no longer need to be providing for, even at that entry point, not just, as you said, for race, but for working class white people.
Thank you. Yes. I'm going to go to Matthew.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is such a complex kind of issue. And I think that, you know, I think Munira's critique of multiculturalism is an interesting conceptual critique, although I often kind of wonder where the evidence is for the specific interactions that she talks about, the kind of implication of resentment and of ghettoisation. And I want to kind of know, well, I can see how conceptually you can make that case, but I want to see more kind of granular evidence that this is really taking place. And of course, there are kind of things about the kind of rather clunky processes which kind of jar. I don't know. I mean, you know, when my son comes back from school and says we're doing Black History Month, and you kind of say he wouldn't come back and say I'm doing White History 11 months. You know, maybe that's the kind of good thing that he's thinking in those terms. There's a very specific issue, I think, a very, very specific issue about multiculturalism, which is the experience of white working class people that they have no sense of identity. But that's a class issue, much more than I think it's a cultural issue. It reflects the kind of inequalities of this country, and it reflects issues around the whole kind of nature of working class, of white working class culture in this country. What also, of course, complicates things now is that the issue of immigration and race is no longer a simple issue. You know, there are plenty of black people who don't like Eastern Europeans arriving and, you know, undercutting them in the labour market, just as there are, you know, white people who feel that way as well. So these issues of race and migration, economic status, have become more complicated than they might have been.
Except the debate in the election was not about those coming in from Europe, was it? It was about those who are coming from outside the EU, which is a colour issue, not an issue.
But interestingly, if you look at where tensions are greatest now, the RSA is doing a piece of work in Peterborough, for example, and in Peterborough, which has got, you know, huge problems, that is all to do with Eastern European migrants. And it's to do with a sense of, which is interesting, is that the kind of typical kind of racist charge is, you know, people have come here to settle down, to kind of, they're somehow, you know, taking, diluting our culture, whatever it might be. The criticism of Eastern Europeans is a reverse, which is they're here to make money and then they want to go back. They don't want to settle here. They don't want to be part. You know, these single men come along, they work very hard, then they send their money home and then they go off. So it's a different kind of thing going on here. So I think it is a more complex, but I don't know whether we get anywhere saying it's more or less or, you know, better or worse. I think it's a more complex picture.
Before I throw out to the audience, but a tourist coming into London from any country in the world and goes into Trafalgar Square and sees this, what do they take from it, do you think? Because the messages of multiculturalism in Britain, I mean, they're quite deep for us. But in terms of art, what did you hope, Yinka, that your average tourist might get from this rather wonderful piece of art?
I mean, I will answer your question, but I want to answer your question, first of all, with very deep thought about Munira's position. Because, and I'm actually being, I think what I'm trying to say about what Munira's actually said is that actually, you know, I actually understand it. I think that what Munira, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what you're trying to say really is that it's time to start treating all of us as human beings so that we have a level playing field and we can apply, you know, we don't have to have this kind of special ghetto, which becomes the only opportunity, you know, the only way that we can actually get opportunity. I'm assuming that's what you're saying. So in other words, I'm actually assuming that in many ways, perhaps, correct me if I'm wrong, but perhaps your aspirations for minority groups might be slightly earlier than society can actually achieve.
And I don't think it is too early, because I think one of the problems with this, with the way in which diversity policies and positive action schemes work, is that they're actually, it's not just that we've outlived their usefulness, it's that they've actually become very counterproductive. They've actually stopped ethnic minorities from applying from mainstream schemes. They've actually started to rigidly define artists. So, you know, there is evidence that, you know, there was a very good report which I co-published by Sonia Dyer, who is a writer and a commentator. She's a black artist as well. And, you know, she interviewed lots of her peers who work in the art sector who feel uncomfortable about applying for schemes where they feel that they're only getting positions because of the colour of their skin, or they feel that they're only getting rung up during Black History Month. You know, that's the opportunities that are available to them. So I'm not saying that racism is dead. I'm saying that, in fact, a lot of these schemes which are designed to address racism and discrimination, etc., have actually started re-racializing us. You know, they reinforce this perception that an artist is a black artist and that this artist can't succeed. And so it's not so much that we've moved on and things have got better. It's that actually these schemes are counterproductive in terms of trying to deliver equality.
Okay. And Yinka, can I And sorry, I know, rather than us getting bogged down in the minutiae of this, and I know it's very important, I also kind of want to talk about the art.
But you see, what Minoru has said has actually led me to the art.
Yes.
Because in what you said is the art. Now, I need to explain what I mean by this. By, regardless of your ethnic background, by simply producing work which is transcendental, divine, and with enchantment, you are transcending those racial fixings. So in other words, what I'm saying is, I know that I certainly, I have benefited from some of the positive discrimination policies. I got an Arts Council grant earlier, and I've also got grants from London Arts Board very early on in my career. I got those to enable me to start. And then, you know, I have my career is about 15 years old. There's no dispute. I consider myself mainstream, right? But leading us to the art, which you want to talk about, is the point that because I got this leg up, I've been able to express myself as an artist eventually. That doesn't exclude expressing cultural specificity in the art. The work is culturally specific, it's autobiographical, but essentially it is art. So to answer your question about what I want people to take from the work, I want them to experience art. Then they may go further. Why has he done it that way? But the first engagement is, I'm touched by this, I mean, you know, what, and then, you know, following from that, what does it mean? And that hence, that's where the cultural specificity comes up.
Just very quickly, I mean, I'm not against bursaries for artists. I'm pro-bursaries. I think we should have them. I think we should allow artists to develop. My point is that the bursaries that are currently exclusively for ethnic minorities shouldn't be exclusively for ethnic minorities. There is currently a course at the Royal College of Art. The Royal College of Art has a very prestigious curating MA, and it's known around the world. It's extremely competitive to get onto it. Through the Arts Council, it's created a separate MA, which is for curating, which is exclusively for ethnic minorities, for black curators. And they get a bursary to go on that course. And it's a different course. It has an internship, but it has less of the kind of the teaching elements or different teaching elements to the prestigious mainstream curating course. Now, if you're a young black person who wants to become a curator, the temptation is to go for the black-only course, which has a bursary, because you think you'll get on it and you'll get some funding. Actually, though, it's a different course. Now, that's segregated education. You know, we haven't seen that in this country ever before.
But we've had
it in America in the 1950s.
I'm very sorry to interrupt, but am I hearing a subtext? Is black negative for you?
No, not at all. But I'm saying that it shouldn't be this idea that there is a segregation in universities. I mean, how can that be a positive thing?
Yasmin.
The reason why these things have had to happen in both the United States and the UK is because those people, young people, ambitious people, who want to go places, whether it's in politics, the media, or the arts, their potential has still not been seen as much as it should be. And until the gatekeepers change and the gatekeepers understand that they can't simply operate like they've always operated, as we've seen in this election this time, and the best people get in, and how come the best people always end up being white men? I think it was quite clear.
I'm going to move on.
I want to say one very important thing. Maybe we should talk about interculturalism rather than multiculturalism, because I do think that we've reached a place now where we shouldn't be locked into one identity or a very narrow sense of who we are and what our art is. I agree with that. But to think that, to say that these young people don't want to get into mainstream, It's simply not true. They just can't.
Yasmin, I'm sure that the audience from the ums and the ahs that I'm hearing, I'm quite sure the audience are going to jump in on this. Can I just jump to Matthew one moment before for a one-sentence response before I jump out to the audience? Thank you.
I just wanted to say that obviously in this conversation we have to recognise that different arts, different fields of art, have different stories to tell. You know, I have two young sons who go to school in South London. They are completely in, you know, for them, what culture is grime music. Now, grime is an incredibly interesting emergence which fuses kind of, you know, hip-hop traditions from America with, you know, interestingly now, it's one of the first musical forms, in artistic forms, that has given an expression actually to white working class a kind of culture and attitudes, but in a really interesting kind of way. So, you know, if you're talking to young people, having this conversation with young people, and they were talking about the kind of culture that meant most to them, they'd be, you know, they would have a very different reference point, I think.
Thank you. That gentleman there. Just to let you know, we have about 35 minutes. So if I don't get to you immediately, we've got time, and I'm going to go to that gentleman at the back after that. Thank you.
I've got a question for Yinka, but just before that, I just want to address the Royal College of Art issue. My name's Jack Tan. I'm the president of the Students' Union at the Royal College of Art. I would just want to say that it's very interesting that when there are positive discrimination things set up, like the curating contemporary art issue, we jump to stereotypes of saying, oh, it must be worse than the other one, that the existing curating course must be the better one, and the black curating course, the minority curating course, is not as good. I mean, my opinion is that it's harder to get onto that course than the original course, because you need to take two sets of interviews, not only with the college, but with the host institution, and you've got to work 4 days a week and have and do an MA exactly at the same time as well. So, you know, I kind of would caution. And the other issue is that on the main course, I think up to 30% are black minority ethnic as well. So it's not true that only minority ethnic people apply for the BME course, the curating course. The question for Yinka really is very interesting, is about what you said about cultural specificity. And I was interested to know whether you saw multiculturalism itself as material, whether it itself is relational, multiculturalism itself as space, or maybe multiculturalism itself could be architecture that you're working with.
Thank you. Yinka.
Wow, that's a very intelligent question. But I think any artist, regardless of where you're from, your form, the expression of your form, should be the continuation of content. I don't know if that makes any sense. So that what the thing looks like, the materials that it's made of, is intrinsically linked to the content of the thing. To the point where if it starts to work, the two things become inseparable. You know, I mean, there's some more kind of abstract ideas about, you know, the creation of art, really. But I think for me, so that, you know, the identity that you express in something is equally expressed in the shape that kind of manifests.
Good, thank you. Yeah. That gentleman there, thank you.
Yeah, my name's Richard Reeser. For my sins, I'm on the plinth committee that selected Yinka's work, and I'm very pleased it's there. But I also, in my day job, work with schools on developing equality and inclusion. And it seems to me that the comments about having gone past the need for positive action are not reflected in what is actually happening in our society. The vast majority of people are still extremely disadvantaged, and race plays an extra part in that disadvantage. If I was to say, and what about other differences, like the largest minority group, which are disabled people in this country, I think it's very, very clear that there's huge disadvantage. And if you're black and disabled and a woman, then there's extra disadvantage. So we haven't got this sorted out yet. And therefore, positive action, I agree with Yasmin, really, that we have to keep this going. But I don't think it should be a ghetto. I think it's there to challenge all organisations that they have to get their house in order and sort things out, while at the same time, those who can make it in the open market should do so. I think you have a dual track approach, not rather one or the other. And I think we have to keep doing that until the statistics, which are very clear of the discrimination, suggest that we can't do that. I have a question for Yinka.
Thank you.
which is, as not only a black artist, but also a disabled artist, do you see any connections with this piece of work on the position of disabled people in society? And I'll tell you why I think that. Because I think the one side of the coin was imperialism and colonialism. Another side at home was that disabled people were locked away because they were not fit to go out and build an empire. And that has been part of the way that our culture has, and the oppression of both groups has actually developed in our society. I'd be interested
Great.
In your comment.
Thank you. Before Yinka answers that, or anybody else answers that, sorry, I forgot to do a little bit of housekeeping. Can I ask that the questions are questions and not statements? Because it becomes very difficult for anybody to reply to that. And if they are, in fact, a statement, do I have the permission of the House to stop the statement and seek the question? I do?
Yeah. I think you should, I think you should allow people to make
Thank
statements.
Well, that's why I asked the question, and it seems...
but you should keep it as long as it's short.
Okay, can I then
short
ask,
statements.
Can it be
just,
a very precise statement?
Yes.
Just not throwing things.
And then, followed by a rather quick question. Thank you very much, Inke, if you'd like to respond to that gentleman there.
Okay. I will respond. You see, in many ways, I've answered your question by the kinds of things I do in my work. Now, I know, Yasmin, you refused your MBE.
No, I sent it back.
You sent it back.
I was stupid. I took it and then sent it.
Yes, you took it.
Doubly stupid.
Yes, you took it and you sent it back. I think, actually... I think you doing that, in a way, has actually helped my generation. And I think, actually, it was necessary for you to do that. Because, you see, I think, in a way, my thinking, and it does relate, it's an answer to your question as well, by becoming the power that oppresses you deliberately, it becomes more difficult to know that you're small. I don't know if that answers anything. So what I'm trying to say is the guise of actually saying, okay, actually, you know what? I'm not going to stay on the other side. I'm going to step in and I'll protest there. Some people might say it doesn't work, but that's my strategy.
Thank you. That lady there, and I'll follow it with that gentleman there. Thank you. Has his hand up. Thank you very much, madam. In the madam in the purple. Microphone's coming to you, madam. Thank you.
Hello, good evening. I'll try and make a concise statement followed by a question, a blurry question. For me, as I'm coming from a literary arts background. And I'm always concerned and quite often surprised, and of some of what I've heard from certain people this evening, disappointed at the language that is being used. Because for me, where I come from, in terms of my positioning, it's like we won't change some of these issues around multiculturalism, gender, race, unless we change the language we use. So I do appreciate, on one level, Munira talking about not wanting to ghettoise. None of us want to be ghettoised because it's, you know, a very kind of a negative kind of thing. But at the end of the day, you've got to be consistent with that. And you just showed how inconsistent you were in the saying, for example, just to take one of your statements, you co-published something with Sonia Dyer, who happened to be a black artist as well. You know, I mean, what kind of ghettoization is that? So for me, it's kind of like in terms of, I wanted this kind of a general question to anybody in terms of the steps of language, about how do we start changing the language that is used so that we can move away from this ghettoization around multiculturalism?
Thank you. I'm going to go to you and then I'm going to Matthew. And I forgive me, and I know that there's a general tone of wanting to discuss at what Manera has said. I don't want this to be a bash Manera
time.
Yeah,
I don't mind. No, I don't mind.
That's why. I don't think
it's
I
not
did
about
bash
you. Yeah, actually, it's not about you. It's about the debate, which is why I was saying that I didn't want statements, because that's what would happen. Sorry. And actually, what I want to happen is a debate about what we're here to talk about. So off you go.
I just want to make the point about, you know, describing Sonia as a black artist, which she did in the report, because she was writing partly from a personal experience. That was what inspired her to write it. And I just wanted to clarify, because I do think that it's very difficult for a white person to sit up here and say what I've just said, which is a problem in our society. We do have, there is a taboo around discussing race, about saying that racism has changed in the last 20 years. And I've argued it for 10 years, and I'm often criticised and people disagree with me, but I've got used to that. Whereas a lot of white people don't say that, because any white person says that, and they're immediately accused of being naive, unwittingly racist, etc., etc. So I only made that point because I thought it was important to explain why she'd written that report and that she did come from a position of experience, not just as an observer. And she didn't claim her experience was universal, but she did research with lots of other artists. And I'm speaking about her, she's not here, so...
And on that point, Matthew, would you like to make a pronouncement on what was asked?
No, not because it wasn't interesting, but because I have... Let's keep the conversation flowing.
Very, very good. Thank you. That gentleman there.
OK, this is not bash Manera night, but she is opening herself to lots of egg-throwing or tomato-throwing. The simple question is, and I'm going to state it very short afterwards, are you saying what you think, or are you saying what Boris has told you to say? And just in terms of what the last thing you said... Where is this taboo about talking about racism? Some of us have lived here for 50-odd years, and we've been discussing racism. There are lots of white people who, when they make pronouncements on racism, are not dismissed as naive or whatever. So I don't know where you're getting all this information from. Who's saying racism is
taboo?
Thank
you. Is that the question? And can I just say, sir, and if I could, just my own personal observation, please forgive me, not defending, but to it might sound slightly patronising to say to someone, are they articulating the views of their boss rather than their own views when someone has written about it for 10 years? But I will let you answer it. Thank you.
I'm probably more bold about saying these things than I think Boris would be, to be honest. I don't like talking about my own personal history as a defence of my arguments, because I think, you know, the reason I make my arguments is because I think they're rational, and I think that they are, you know, based on what I see around me and what I've observed in my own work, my research. But, you know, I grew up in Oldham in the 1980s. I'm not naive about racism. And it's because of the experience of having seen it and having seen what policies can do and how they can inadvertently divide communities, and that the riots that took place in 2005, I would argue, came partly as a result of the way that policing had changed, the way that community relations had changed. And I'm not criticising people who work in this world and saying that they are intentionally trying to create problems, but I think that, you know, having observed it and having researched it, it seems to me that there are real problems with the way that we talk about race today. And the fact that the reaction to what I'm saying is obviously very strong, and I can understand that. A lot of people have very bad and, you know, have had very negative experiences with racism. I'm not, you know, denying that. But I do think we do have a responsibility to try and discuss it and to be willing to hear ideas we feel uncomfortable about.
Thank you. Matthew?
I think what's kind of interesting listening to this conversation, and I'm kind of glad I'm not the person getting things thrown at me, which is unusual when you have a New Labour background. But, perhaps we'll talk about the Iraq War.
Correct. Just to warm it up.
And a kind of traditional, kind of liberal critique of racism would be that what racism does is it says that what you say and what you do doesn't matter. It's not legitimate because of something else about you, your colour or your background or whatever it might be. And I think I can't help observing that what's interesting in this conversation between a group of people who are kind of, you know, interesting, aggressive people interested in art, is that the critique is not simply a critique of ideas. There is a critique of Manera going on here, which is about her legitimacy in saying these things. Now, that is I just find that kind of quite an interesting thing, that we're kind of questioning the legitimacy of points of view that we don't agree with, which, you know, it's a problematic position, I think, to be honest. It's not as if things are being said which are kind of, perhaps they are. Perhaps people feel views that are different to their own are deeply offensive. But, you know, it's interesting in the context of a conversation about art that there's a kind of implication that there are views which are not legitimate and almost shouldn't be expressed.
OK, thank you. Can I just say, there are about six people with their hands up. I think I've got you, and I'm going to go to you, and then I'm going to open up and ask for some more. So in this order, if I have two microphones, I have that lady there, which I think is in a kind of peachy kind of top, and I have that woman there with the kind of flowery thing at the back of her head. And then I'm going to go to that woman there who has the kind of camera-y thing in her hand. It is those first three, and then I will review. Thank you.
Hi, I'm a simple person. But this whole, I'd like to bring back to the original debate topic and the use of racism. This whole evening reminds me of something my father used to say. I came back from school when I was in this country for a while. I was going to school in this country, and I said, "Oh, Daddy, what's this? Someone said something was racist." Said, "I don't know what all this racist is. There's no such word. It's called lack of education." And I think, well, here's my question. Do you not think that art is education and none so much as the message in a bottle? It's encouraging. I saw some children yesterday in Trafalgar Square, and they were asking, "Well, why has it got African material on the sails?" Even just about Nelson, they didn't know. I think Boris mentioned that yesterday. Do you not think art is, which is a big responsibility for people like you, Yinka, is art not, I'm opening it to the panel, an education that... Well,
thank you, madam. I've got it. Yasmin, thank you.
Well, I don't think art can always be education. Sometimes it is. I don't see this as education. I think it's so much more than that. It's provocative. I love the idea that it's confusing things.
Do you not think that art...
what I don't...
Racism. It's the context of...
No, I think some very educated people are highly racist, so I don't necessarily have faith in... But I don't want to talk about race. I'm talking about... You asked me, is art education? It can be. It can also provoke all sorts of feelings. It can make you react in ways which eventually might change you. I do believe in the redemptive qualities of art. But art and education is a very important activity. But I don't think of this piece as education. I just can't. I'm sorry.
Great, thank you very much. Who's the next person with the microphone? I think it's you, madam.
Hi. I just want to say that it was harping on back to a thing earlier about Nelson, and someone mentioned disability, and actually Nelson was disabled when he won the Battle of Trafalgar. He was missing an arm and an eye. So I think that's quite an interesting thing to add in.
Good, thank you.
No question.
Very good, thank you very much. Let's go on to I think there's a lady back there.
Yeah,
and can I just lay out, before you ask the question, can I just lay the ground for the next? I'm going to work down this side. Can I go to that gentleman there who has the T-shirt on? And then I'll go to that woman there with a rather attractive green brooch, and I'll go to this woman here. Thank you very much. Then I'll work my way back up that way. Thank you very much.
I'm going to make a very quick statement, and then there's a question. The statement
wow,
is...
Wow, I wish I didn't rescind on that
it's
statement.
Very, no,
I'm
listen,
telling you.
The very
please.
Quick thing is, the statement is that I want everybody to go and look at the picture. Look at the picture. I mean, the installation at night. Because I went there last night after a celebration event for the unveiling of the plinth. And the glass and the light and the whole thing is absolutely incredible. At night, so I'm going to tell that's my statement. Go and look at it, not only in the day, but at night. And then when I was looking at it in the night, it brought on all the contradictions of what might be there. And I'm wondering if that's what is meant in it, because it looks so joyful sailing in the night. And I'm thinking, am I meant? But then it was opening up the empire. So but the empire brought everybody here as well. So. I'm meant to look and experience all those contradictions as I look at it, racing and enjoying itself.
Thank you so much, madam. That gentleman there with the T-shirt.
It's a statement.
it's a bloody pleasure to hear an artist talk about a piece of work as something that was actually thought about, made, adjusted, put into space, given a life, and I thank you for that. Question, well, actually half statement, a little bit of question.
So one and a half statements and half a question.
Actually, it's an evening, I think it's an evening devoted to imagination, because a lot of the pictures we've seen are taken from places that no human can go. You've got to be a pigeon. So this is a very nice thing that it's, you know, we're the only, you know, the cat can't do that. The birds don't actually do that. We do that. We are well spatial. And I want to know, Yinka, what would you change if you could?
In the work itself?
In the art, of course. In the bottle.
In the bottle. What would I change? I mean, that's a difficult one, because I will need time to think about it. And I didn't have an answer already, so.
Thank you very much, lady in the green brooch. Thank you.
This is a question from Manira. Could it not be the case that racism has reduced enormously, as you've said, and I agree with, and that these affirmative action type schemes ghettoize people, and that there are negatives to it, so that the Black people end up applying for those schemes and not for other schemes? Can it not be the case that that's all true, but that racism in the art world is perhaps so unique in its own particular way that, in spite of the fact that racism perhaps doesn't exist even elsewhere or is reduced massively elsewhere, that it is necessary to have these kinds of schemes in the art world in particular because of the nature of racism in the art world? Could that not be the case?
I mean, I think the arts world, actually, more than other policy areas, other sectors, is more racialized, and that is partly a result of the, you know, the policies and the particular way in which the Arts Council and other organizations have thought about it. So actually, I think there is much more consciousness and sensitivity about race in the arts world than I've seen in any other sector, in sectors I've researched. I think that the reason why there is a disproportionately small number of ethnic minorities in the art sector is the same reason why there's a disproportionately small number of people from state schools in the art sector. People from BME backgrounds are disproportionately working class, so there is inevitably a link there. But there are more and more Black artists coming through, Black curators. The younger generation will have more opportunities. So I think if you try to look at the statistics of the number of ethnic minorities in the art sector, and you just read from that there is racism, it hides a very complex picture. And one of the things that we started doing in the GLA is looking at unpaid internships, which is a massive barrier. For anyone who wants to start working in the arts world, you have to work for a year for free. Now, inevitably, that means that certain people will go on and be successful and will get the work experience they need to get a first job. To me, that just seems like the more obvious area to invest. If we're going to invest public funding to try and open up access, that should be the area we start with. But I don't think, and I know that Yasmin and many others disagree with me, I don't think that the discrimination and prejudice of old forms of racism exist as they used to. And I think that there are new prejudices that have been fueled by lots of these policies.
Just to let you know, guys, that we've got like 11 minutes left of this debate. So could we please, please make the statements tremendously short and make the question as pithy as possible? Thank you.
I would argue that the reason why the arts world, actually compared to the world of the media, which I know, and the world of politics, has actually opened up more, although it's not there yet, is because they've been made to be conscious. They have been. The fact that the RSC today, you can see any play, and it has got multi-racial casting, didn't just happen. It happened because serious people sat down and thought about it. And I do give credit to the arts world for that. It hasn't happened nearly enough in the media. And I also want to really disagree with you, Matthew, that I think to say that we have not discussed, that, you know, when people disagree, there was something. I think people have been perfectly charming, perfectly polite in objecting or debating issues. If we can't do that, then really what are we supposed to do here? So I don't think it's fair to say we didn't allow people to have opinions. We are disagreeing with each other's opinions, which is what it should be like.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
This is the second time, Yasmin, you've misportrayed what's been said on the stage.
I'll come back to you in a moment. Thank you.
Seems to be a
short comment and a question. Yinka, thanks for your work. I do like the piece. And I think it really is a kind of statement of multiculturalism in its best form, in a sense. You know, because the idea is it's, you know, cultures competing and really you want equality. And I think you've managed to sort of do that in a kind of way and still put yourself and your background in it. And I think it's the idea of space. Okay, question. Matthew, thinking recently, I watched a clip from Soul to Soul lead person. The name has just slipped me. Jazzy B. And he was, you can go on Guardian online and have a look at it. But he was discussing, he was quite sad about the situation with music. You mentioned grime and grime and how it's owned. And in terms of, I think it's kind of a point against where multiculturalism can be negative and where it can go, is where a certain cultural expression is not promoted and kind of owned by certain groups. I don't know if that makes sense. I mean, do you want to comment?
Thank you. Well, the point I wanted to make about my sons is just that the kind of world that they live in is so, it's a kind of very different kind of conversation than this, and it's weird in a way. I mean, they say things, they're white middle-class boys, but nearly all their friends, just the schools they went to, what they do, are black, and there is a kind of knowingness between them and their friends, and they say things which, were we to say those things, would seem completely outrageous, but that's to do with the fact that they seem to have got to a kind of stage of mutual respect or kind of integration or whatever it might be. I don't know what it is, but it's not as right on as this conversation, but yeah, it's a more relaxed conversation, and it's kind of quite interesting for me. The thing I'm surprised we haven't talked about at all, really, it was raised at the back, the point about education, is this question of whether art is there to do anything, Because I thought that when we talked about art and multiculturalism, that what we would have is a debate that one has a lot, which is, is art there to achieve anything? And often artists, I did an event about 2 years ago, and I suggested that it was reasonable for artists to be asked the question, where are you in relation to climate change? Not that they had to be drawing pictures of icebergs, but, that it would be a question, how does this impact your work would be a legitimate question. And the person who was on the panel with me was so offended by this question that she refused to answer any other questions. So, and it was a rather self-defeating protest because it meant I answered every question myself. But but there is a kind of debate here about instrumentality. And my own view is that all art is instrumental. It's just that there's high instrumentalism and low instrumentalism. And low instrumentalism art is there to achieve kind of some social purpose, to keep young people out of prison or to improve people's health. And there's a high instrumentalism, which is art is there to kind of lift us up in some kind of more diffuse way. And I think that what is interesting about the conversation of art and multiculturalism is it does take us to this question of whether art is there to build better citizens. And I think it's a really interesting, we haven't kind of touched on it as much as I'd like to tonight.
Good, thank you very much. My answer, not even an answer, but an observation would be that was very much a debate of leading up to 2000, wasn't it, about art and instrumentalism. And when James Purnell came in, he said, let's move away from that argument and now let's do art for art's sake. Yeah. And let's move.
Which I think is a facile point.
What one could do, yeah. I mean, that's the debate, isn't it?
Even though I love James.
Yeah. okay, there's a gentleman there. Can I just have the hands up on this side? There's a gentleman there. And then there is this gentleman there who's had his hand up for a long time with the blue pen. And then there's this woman here in the blue top. Rather fetching. thank you.
This is just a question.
Great!
And it's just designed to see whether we can get any agreement from the panel. Whether or not any sort of positive action is good, isn't good, is still needed, isn't still needed, do the panel agree that there should be a time in the future when there is no need for positive action because there is genuine equality? That's hopefully quite an easy question to answer. And if they do agree to that, how will we recognize when we have achieved it?
Thank you, Yinka.
Well, I mean, in a way, I think what the scenario you're describing is a nightmare scenario.
That's so
And the reason, and I'm going to be extremely crude. You do have to excuse me, but I'm going to be crude, and there's a reason for this. Imagine a situation in which we don't have, now we've got, you know, we've got gents, we've got ladies, right? I remember when I was at college, the student union, you know, we actually had to fight to make provision for places for women to put tampons in the, you know, in the toilets. The provisions were not made. In the student union, we fought for this. Now, this is a rather crude example, but what it says to you immediately is that the moment you say we're all equal, actually what you begin to do is to deprive people of what they really need. So we are not all made the same. We have certain needs. Society must take those into account. Imagine buildings with no access for disabled people because we are supposed to be treated equally. So no lifts, no ramps. So equality or the same is a nightmare scenario.
Thank you.
Full stop.
Thank you. Yasmin.
One wishes, and up to a point, things are a little bit better than they were. And I'm an idealist. I keep hoping there will come a day when, you know, I don't need to talk like this. And sometimes we do reach it. I think a few years ago, I honestly felt we'd kind of reach a space where we could begin to break. And I wrote After Multiculturalism, and I still stand by that book, actually. But I now see how it's all kind of tumbling again. And I don't think life goes in a straight line. I think it is like one of these wheels. You go up, it goes back. Another generation has to struggle for it. And that is what makes it exciting. What makes London so exciting is that we're all grappling with these ideas. If we got really comfortable, I don't mean to be rude to Swedish people, but they tell me, or Canadians, that, you know, when there isn't that tension, society actually becomes a little bit boring. So I don't know.
Minera, thank you.
I am in favour of progress. I don't think it makes us boring. I think it makes us a better society. And I do hope that one day we'll have a society where people are treated equally. That doesn't mean being treated the same. I mean, I have I suppose what you might call a kind of liberal argument, which is that in the public space, in the law courts, the way that the police treat us, how we are treated when we arrive at the borders, how we're treated in education, that we should be treated as equal citizens. And obviously recognising that not everybody will have the same needs and requirements, but that fundamentally we are each respected and treated according to our need. And so, I think that it would be an ideal world, and it would be good if we could not start to divide people up in what I think are not categories that are increasingly irrelevant to the reality in which we live, the ways in which we live. You know, we have more mixed-race people now in Britain than we did 20 years ago. They don't fit into the categories of, you know, the way in which policymakers think. I think that's a problem. I think we need
Can I just quickly add that in understanding difference, in understanding that we have different needs, you do have to make different kinds of budgets and different kinds of provisions to meet those different kinds of needs.
I don't want to get into the argument of disability, because I do think that's a slightly different thing, and I think I'm not trying to group all these things together.
Good, then I won't let you. Thank you, okay. Matthew.
History and culture it's all about kind of people rediscovering things and saying, here is something which we haven't talked about enough, here's a group of people we haven't understood enough, here's a bit of history we haven't seen, and that will always go on. So for me, progress is not going to be that we don't discover groups or people and say, actually, we need to invest in these people, or we need to invest in understanding this period, or we need to understand this bit of history. It's when we can do that without people resenting it. That will be when we know we've made real progress.
Thank you. I think there's a gentleman. I'm on my last two questions, ladies and gentlemen. I think there was a gentleman there in what I thought was a really... Was that right? Who has the microphone now? Where you? So No. So you didn't want to ask a question? Yeah, it was, that gentleman there. Oh, sorry, all right, let's go to here.
Let's go to this gentleman here. Sorry.
There are problems about relating to identifying or relating and identifying with the self. There's also an assumption how one is supposed to respond to the questions of addressing to the self in relationship to all those around them. And I wonder, at a point like this, where we decide that we're going to debate multiculturalism, which has turned out to be much more of a critique of it than against a debate of it, how do we address the question of a norm?
Manera.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I'll... I don't understand the question. I'm going to have to ask you to clarify.
Well, if I understand the question right, you know, what is the norm in the context of an incredibly diverse society? And that would go back to the point I would make earlier, that I think there is a norm, and that norm is white establishment middle-class culture. And that has been the norm, and that's why, in my view, there is a particular issue, and there has been a particular issue about white working-class culture, which is that has been excluded. And in the conversation about multiculturalism, it has too often been the notion that white people, as a group, are privileged, and people from other ethnic backgrounds are not, and that has missed out the oppression of white working class people. And that has been, I think, a failure of imagination around the way in which multiculturalism has been described. And multiculturalism has therefore suffered from class inequality. And that has been one of the things that has allowed those people who are hostile to its very notion to caricature it.
Very good. Manira just had a quick thing, yeah, and then that lady in the blue.
You know, white curators are not, you know, don't just focus on white culture. I think, you know, a few years ago there was a something called the Festival of Muslim Cultures, or I can't remember the precise name of it, but it was about looking at different cultures and arts arising from the Islamic world. And one of the interesting things that came from it was that some of the best and most experienced curators of Islamic art in Britain are white. We can't assume, and I absolutely agree with Matthew, I think we should be curious about the world, and we should have funding to ensure that we have museums that are full of the richness of cultures from all around the world, but we shouldn't assume that it's only black people who know about black culture, it's only white people who know about white culture. And what I'm arguing for is an understanding that we transcend the cultures that we come from as well. We come from a place, but we're also like the ship in a bottle travelling to places.
Thank you.
That leads very well into my question, and which I'm seeking clarification from Manera, really. Yes, not only white curators will deal in white culture, but black people and black artists know a lot about black experience, and the arts is the sector in this country where I think we've been having the most sophisticated conversations in the last 50 years about identity and race, much more so than in the political sphere, which the conversations about race have been of a much just cruder kind of level. So I think there are a lot of people who feel embattled when we hear your comments about race and multiculturalism and the arts, because it's quite narrow to think about policy and positive discrimination. That's quite a narrow kind of element of this bigger picture of multiculturalism in the arts. And I think of myself as being part of a multicultural arts sector, and I think of a great swathe of black, Asian, post-colonial artists and writers who are having conversations amongst themselves about identity. And quite often, from the timbre of your kind of comments about ghettoisation and, you know, interculturalism, I kind of feel embattled that I feel that you kind of regret that movement, and I see that movement has been it's been incredibly important for us as a society and individually for artists, that there's so much intellectual capital in there, and people like Yinka represent a whole kind of three generations of work that have gone on in this country, that I just feel that your kind of policies and your position now as a mayor's advisor and everything that you say, I feel that you're sort of I feel that you're kind of critiquing and bashing that sector, and maybe you're not. So could you clarify?
Yeah, I'm not bashing the history and the movement. You know, I'm part of the anti-racism movement. I meet people and talk to people and have friends who work in that world. There are people within that world who are also critical of things that are going on. And the reason that I pick out policies like positive discrimination is because that's the point where there is a real clash. And that's where there is a debate, and that's why I pick it out, because actually we could all end up agreeing with each other today and we would all go home and it would all be nice, but we wouldn't have had a disagreement, and I think the disagreement's important. So I don't want to offend people who've worked in this world. I'm part of that world. But I do think that it's important to recognise that there are disagreements and that they are valid to voice.
Great. I think it's only right that the last word
should come to Yinka.
Yeah.
I should go to Yinka. And Yinka, we've been talking here about all of these subjects, and in a kind of way, there's always this tension, isn't there, that art gets reduced to politic. I have to say, and I am someone who describes myself as an artist who is black, a black artist first, and just very briefly, I am part of that wave of positive discrimination that came from the Blair government. I then opened my plays at the National Theatre, which now play worldwide, and my new latest play is about to go into New York. I'm unsure what ghetto I sit in, but I do know that I stand firmly, and I benefited firmly from a culture that has discussed my cultural specificity and allowed me to work through that lens and has given me the space that otherwise I would not have, because there is too much other noise when it comes to art and validating the norm. So I'd like to come to you finally, just to kind of get your take on, again, I'm asking, what you want us to get from this wonderful piece of art. Because I tell you what I get. I get all of the stories that we've been discussing, but I also get, here is a wonderful imagination. Here is someone that, if I want to, like an old Public Enemy record, that if I want to get down to the lyrics, I can go, yes, fight the power. Or if not, I can just get down to the beat and feel satisfied.
Yeah. Well, you know, I second that. Okay. I actually don't want us to walk away thinking that Munira is the Antichrist or something. No, because this is actually a serious matter, because I think that Munira's position is rather more advanced than we would like to think it. Because I actually think very seriously that there are two separate things going on here. There is the expression of multiculturalism in the arts. And it's always essential for artists to express their difference. And then there is bureaucracy and government policy and the interpretation of multiculturalism through the kind of bureaucratic system. And the debate happening within, if you don't mind me calling it that, within kind of Munira's world, the kind of government world and the policy world, it's quite a separate thing from what's happening in the studio or in the theater. And I think that the bureaucratic world or the policy world, I think actually Munira is quite right in that some of it has become condescending. And the nature of that condescension needs to be addressed. And I think that is what Munira is talking about. I do not think, however, that the need in the studio to continue to explore difference ceases because of what government does. So it's a crucial separation. And I think that I will just end by saying that I'm very grateful for the existence of Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, to name but a few, you know, all these people fought for my rights. As a result of that, we have Obama as the president of the United States. They have allowed me to be collected by MoMA in New York, by the Tate, to be represented by private galleries, and might I add, to be economically viable. I have survived purely working as an artist full time without doing anything else for the past 15 years. So I want to end by paying tribute to the various people who've struggled for my economic viability, because that is political. Money is political. That's all I have to say.
I'm sure your agent will be very pleased at that. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Tate, for hosting.
Thank the panel and Kwame for beautifully hosting. Matthew Taylor, Munira Mertzer, Yasmin Adwai Brown, of course, Yinka, Shani Barre. And I think, Yinka, I agree with what you say, but I think a lot of what you've achieved is due also to your talent. I think that needs to be said. Can I invite you now all to come into the foyer and have a drink with us? Thank you very much tonight.